Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Ambassador Ido Moed joins us the morning after Iran launched its missile and drone attack on Israel. The understanding is that 99% of the Iranian munitions were shot down. And not just by Israel. Israel had help from allies in the region as well. And our prime minister has he's denounced the attack, as has Mr. Polyev. Ambassador Moed, how are you this morning? Or today?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Roy. It's good to be on the show again.
Yeah,
if you ask me how I am, it's always a long answer, so we'll keep it to another time.
Okay.
I'm fine.
Sounds like a plan. So Israel has Iran is saying that they attacked Israel because Israel attacked one of their diplomatic missions in Syria and killed several senior officers of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Israel has not commented on that, but that's the reason Iran has given. What is your position, and what is the Israeli government's position on this attack by Iran?
Iran is
Go ahead, please, Ambassador.
Iran is driven by pure hate against Israel. Iran is bent on destroying the state of Israel, and it has devised a machine, a terror machine, around Israel through proxies, and now attacked it directly. Those who were killed in Damascus are part and parcel of the Al-Quds force, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is part and parcel of this terror machine. So when we are talking about Iran in the Middle East, what they're trying to spread is not just a sort of a religious idea about Shiism, but they're trying to spread terror. They're trying to create a destability in the region. They're trying to destroy the state of Israel. And as we've seen last night, they are also bent on destroying it. And notably, I assume that many of our listeners also have seen the pictures of the incoming missiles falling almost on the Dome of the Rock, which is the third holiest place for Muslims around the world. And it was defended by the Iron Dome, the Jewish state's missile system that defended this incredible symbol for Islam. So they are blinded by hate, and they are bent on destroying anything and everything around us, and as they've shown last night. And on the other hand, you see a group of countries that, together with Israel, understand the nature of this threat, how serious and how deadly it can be, and together helped us mitigate this attack so that 99% of those missiles were intercepted. Only a few of them got through and created some minor damage in a base down south in Israel.
And countries that have helped Israel include countries in the Middle East.
Yes, absolutely. Israel, throughout the years, have reached out to countries in the region and built peaceful relations, not just with Egypt and Jordan, but also with other countries, Gulf countries, Morocco, the Emirates, Bahrain. And these countries and others stand by Israel in the recognition that Iran is a deadly force. Iran is a destructive terrorist organization, state organization that has only one aim, first and foremost, to get rid of Israel, but then also create some kind of a hegemony in the region. And I think that the countries in the region understand that that's also a threat to them, not just for the sake of the protection of Israel, but it is something that is devastating for the whole region. And this is why Iran is so dangerous, and this is why it's so important today to designate the IRGC as a terror organization, and this is why it's so important for the international community to stand up against Iran and to do whatever it can to impose sanctions and to make sure that that regime, the Iranian regime, does not reach nuclear capability in any time in the future. They're extremely dangerous. They are taking their own people hostage, the Iranian people, but the Ayatollah regime is extremely dangerous and needs to be mitigated by the international community entirely.
Now, we've seen how the regime in Tehran treats its own people. How they have, when Iranians have stood up against the regime, how they have been put down extremely violently, and nobody's come to the assistance, international community has not come to the assistance of the Iranian people who were looking for assistance in their quest for freedom. But you tweeted earlier today, or X today, I'm never quite sure what to say. It's time to declare the IRGC a terror organization, which many other countries have done, but this country has not. The prime minister said after one of the ceremonies honoring those who died on flight PS752, dozens included Canadians. He said he's looking for a way to do that. How difficult is that, Mr. Ambassador, to say the IRGC is a terrorist organization?
Each country has their own internal procedure, and I cannot comment on that. But we know today, we see what the IRGC is doing, and we understand, I think everybody around the world, when I'm talking about we, it's not just Israel, but the international community sees what they are capable of. And this is why it's so important to designate them as a terror organization today. It's extremely important. It's not just a political measure. It also is a measure that has consequences, and therefore it's so important.
Ambassador Moed, your Prime Minister Netanyahu has said he who hurts us will be hurt by us. So Iran attacked Israel last night. What now? And your war cabinet has said it's not over.
Israel cannot afford to lose a war. We are a small country, and we cannot afford to lose any war. So when anybody, and we've said at the outset, and this is nothing new to anyone, when anybody harms Israel, if anybody hits Israel, Israel will hit back. Not just as a retaliation, but to make sure that they will never do that again. This is exactly what is happening right now. Iran unleashed this horrendous attack, hundreds of drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, not just themselves, but using their proxies in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq. And it is extremely dangerous. So we have to respond. In our region, when you don't respond, that's a sign of weakness. And not only that, you want to make sure that your enemies understand it is not worth their while to attack Israel. So Israel will respond.
Ambassador, I'll say something for this country as a Canadian citizen. Declaring the IRGC a terror organization should be the most simple thing for this government of Mr. Trudeau to do. It's not a challenge. We lost again. We lost dozens of Canadians in the shooting down of PS752, and that was carried out by the IRGC. But if we're talking about Canada and Canada's relations with Israel, you and I touched on this last weekend, I believe. So Canada, with Mr. Trudeau as prime minister, condemned Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel. Is Israel, though, somewhat unsure of the level of support it has from the Trudeau government, particularly given recent decisions taken and actions taken by this government?
So, as you know, Roy, and I mentioned also in the past, both countries share a very strong, solid basis for the relations. We share the same values. We have the same ideas about how liberal democracies should flourish and how our countries should work together. However, as you mentioned, in the last few months, especially since the beginning of the October 7th war and after this horrific massacre that was condemned by Prime Minister Trudeau very strongly and unequivocally, we have seen some decisions which we lamented, which we found disappointing, which we called to be changed, such as, for example, the support that we were expecting from Canada in the International Court of Justice when it comes to the horrific accusation slanderous accusation by South Africa that Israel is responsible for genocide in Gaza, and also other decisions for which we are still conducting very close contacts and discussions, but as you say, are casting some kind of a shadow, I would say, momentarily shadow, I assume, over the relations. We think that in the current state of affairs, when Iran is openly and directly threatening not just Israel, but the entire Middle East, it is time to put deeds towards and to take action against Iran. And therefore, we are calling for the immediate designation of the IRGC as a terror organization, for sanctions against them, against industries that are behind the UAV industry in Iran and others. It is time to act, and this is the time. Iran is a source of evil in the Middle East at a magnitude that was never experienced before. And I think at this point, moment in time, we expect our friends to stand by us also in this regard.
Ambassador Moed, this isn't really your territory to get into, I don't think, but I'll ask you to just maybe give us a thought or two, because what would you say to Gazans in Canada who are very concerned, deeply concerned about the casualties inflicted on civilian population in Gaza? And now we have situations in Canada where we have Canadians of Palestinian and of Jewish origins and Israeli origin combating each other, confronting each other, which is never good in a country. What would you say to Gazans, and what would you say to Gazan Canadians and to Jewish Canadians, Israeli Canadians?
Thank you, Roy, for this question. I think it's extremely important. It is not exactly my jurisdiction, I would have to admit, but I'm very closely in touch with the Jewish communities, and I hear their concern, and I hear the sense of abandonment at some point in because of the their sense that these hate marches that are taking place on the streets of Canada, they are nothing but hate marches, are aimed against them as Jews, not for any other reason. And this needs to be addressed. Just as we say on our side, our war is against a terror organization called Hamas. It is not against the Palestinians. The same I would expect people to say here, also Palestinians, to understand that the war is not against them. It is not against the political aspirations that Palestinians have. It's against a terrorist organization that has taken also their fellow people hostage. Palestinians in Gaza are human shields for a terrorist organization called Hamas. They are the ones who need their support. And I think that I would call them to extend a hand to them to try to help them.
Okay.
At the same time,
Ambassador,
Hamas.
I'm very sorry. I have to interrupt you. I wasn't paying attention to the clock. I do that a lot. And we're literally out of time, but I think your message has been sent. I do thank you. Appreciate you coming on the program today after last night, and we'll keep a very close eye on what happens going forward. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it, Roy. Thank
you. All the best. You know, there are news stories, and then there are events that some of us in the media, in a way, become part of because of the coverage that we provide. And in the early 90s, I was very much involved in the coverage of the murders of Kristen French and Leslie Mahaffey. I got to know the French and Mahaffey families personally very well. In this studio, we had the head of the Green Ribbon Task Force. That was the Niagara Police unit that was pursuing the suspects in the murders of Leslie Mahaffey and Kristen French. And I remember sitting in this very position of this chair with the head of the Green Ribbon Task Force on my right, saying live on the air, I suspect that the suspects we're looking for will be listening to your program right now. And it was a very chilling thing to hear. And I said, why? And the police officer said, because they want to know what we're doing. And that gave me the feeling that the police are very close to making an arrest, and they did very shortly thereafter. So then we became aware of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka and the deal with the devil, which saw Carla Homolka set free years ago, living comfortably now with her own family. I wonder what she tells her kids. Paul Bernardo has been, as you know, removed from his maximum security prison in Ontario and moved to a medium security prison in Quebec. That got the whole country fired up, rightly so. And he's had parole hearings. Bernardo, parole hearings. And then the French and Mahaffey families wanted to have access to Bernardo's police, or prison records, rather. And the Correctional Service Canada and the parole board said, no, 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 you can't have those. That would be in violation of Mr. Bernardo's privacy rights. So they went to court with their lawyer, Tim Danson, and all the courts leading to the Supreme Court of Canada said the same thing. No, you can't have those records. And Mr. Danson appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada just a few days ago. The Supreme Court did not, as I said earlier, distinguish itself by refusing to even hear the appeal by the French and Mahaffey families. Tim Danson joins us. Tim, what was it like to know, what was it like to hear that the Supreme Court would in fact not even entertain your clients, your friends' appeal for access to the records of Bernardo?
Well, we were very surprised because there is a very specific criteria for leave. Just to put this in context, though, about 90 to 92% of all leave applications are dismissed. Only 8 to 10% are allowed, and then they're divided proportionally among the provinces. So the chances of getting leave are very difficult in the best of circumstances. But having said that, there is a criteria that they use, and we met that criteria 100% in our view. Obviously, the Supreme Court of Canada felt otherwise. But for example, when we were unsuccessful in the federal court trial level and the federal court of appeal, they relied on a case called Mooring, which was decided 27 years ago. So generally, and it's a Supreme Court of Canada decision, and often, you know, the Supreme Court of Canada will say, or I shouldn't say often, almost exclusively, that they're not going to review one of their decisions until a lot of time has passed by. So over a quarter of a century is by far more than enough time for them to reconsider one of their earlier decisions. But here, 23 years after they decided the case in Mooring, they dealt with the issue in part in a case called Bird and said, but on the facts of that case, they didn't have to decide this issue. And so they were going to leave it for another day. Well, our case is that other day. And it's not just that other day. The evidentiary record, which usually the Supreme Court wants, is a comprehensive, tested, reliable evidentiary record to make a decision, was our case. And so we were very confident, as were our Ottawa agents, that leave would be granted because we met the criteria, including that it was a matter of considerable public importance, public interests. It's hard to believe that once again, the rights of a sadistic, sexual, psychopathic murderer like Paul Bernardo, that his privacy rights trumped the rights of the victims and the public's right to know, particularly when you juxtapose that to the Access to Information Act, which is what we were applying under, states as its objective to enhance the accountability and transparency of federal institutions in order to promote an open and democratic society and enable public debate on the conduct of those institutions. How are Canadians able to evaluate whether or not our corrections parole system, which is of considerable public importance because it's all about public safety, is functioning properly if critical evidence is kept from the public? And let me just give you one example. Because we're at all the parole hearings, whether it's Paul Bernardo or it's Clinton Gale, who murdered a police constable, Todd Bayliss, or Craig Monroe, who murdered police constable Michael Sweet. And we're at all these different parole hearings before different parole boards. And these offenders tell very different stories to different panels of the parole board. And the only constant is us, and we introduce this through the victim impact statements. One of the things that we wanted under the Access to Information Act is either the audio recordings of the parole hearings or a transcript. Now, if you wanted a, if any member of the public wanted a transcript of a criminal trial, criminal proceedings, sentencing, dangerous offender applications, we get it because we're protected the right to know, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, protected by 2B of the Charter. Why does that change for the parole board? They're determining the end stage of a sentence. Paul Bernardo and others are asking to be relieved from the full consequences of their life sentence so they can be reintegrated into society. Well, society would be very much alarmed to know that a sexual, sadistic, psychopathic murderer may be amongst their midst. And so they have a right to know the evidence that Paul Bernardo and the parole board might be relying upon. So this was a case that was of such monumental importance. And as I say, we otherwise met the criteria that we were very disappointed and surprised that we didn't get leave. And so now we're going to have to turn to shows like yours and other media to educate the Canadian public, to then reach out to their members of parliament and say, we're not going to take this. This is not acceptable. You cannot treat sadistic, sexual, psychopathic murderers who have life sentences and have been declared dangerous offenders, so they have an indefinite sentence in addition to their life sentence, and treat them the same way as federal offenders who have fixed sentences who are going to get out at some point in time. It just, with all due respect to everybody, it just boggles my mind. This is really, really simple. And I'm reminded when we argued the videotape issue in the mid-90s, when the public and the media were trying to get access to these awful, unspeakable Bernardo Homolka videotapes. And you walk into the courtroom and there's 30 plus lawyers and we're all in our gowns. And you've got piles and piles of books of authority. And we came out of the court, Justice Lesage reserved, and Donna French said something to me. And she just cut through it all. And she says, you know, Tim, some things are right and some things are wrong. And this is just wrong. You don't need thousands of pages of case law. Every Canadian knows in their gut, they know intuitively that this is wrong and we need to change the laws. If the courts aren't going to do it, Parliament should. And quite frankly, it really is more Parliament's responsibility than the courts.
You know, I suspect, Tim, that from the vast majority of Canadians listening, and most people have at least a peripheral sense of the case. They know what happened, and they've been able to pick up various aspects of it as time goes by, and you've represented the families. But it's still listening to you, and I was so close to it. Listening to you, I still sit here and I'm absolutely aghast at the decision taken by the Supreme Court of this country. We're talking about, as you said, it's just there's the right thing to do. And you don't need a law degree. You don't need years as a successful lawyer. You don't need years as a judge to be appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada to know what the right thing to do is. Ask a kid; they'll tell you. It's very, very, very disturbing. So this sets you back, but it's not the end. But you need parliamentary involvement. You need a law passed. All of that takes time unless they decide together to do it quickly, which they should. And they should have maybe foreseen this or taken care of it years ago. But here we are with Paul Bernardo's privacy rights being superseding the victim's family's rights to know what they need to know, what you need to know to represent them the next time that individual finds himself at a parole hearing.
And what it means, Roy, is, and let me be very frank about it, is that as it relates to the corrections and parole system, which is probably one of the most important government institutions that exists in terms of the general public's interest because of their public safety, what this means is that the Access to Information Act is meaningless. That's what it means. So here I again, I don't mean to repeat myself, but its objective is what you would expect in a democratic society, to enhance accountability and transparency in federal institutions in order to promote an open and democratic society, enable public debate, and the conduct of those institutions is now been rendered meaningless. And that is very, very disturbing. I've said this on your show before, you know, what's worse than losing is not trying. And we're going to continue the good fight because we're right. I would have obviously preferred that the Supreme Court of Canada granted leave. I don't mean this literally, but I would have preferred to have been able to argue the case on the merits before the Supreme Court of Canada and lose than not being heard at all. And I feel, and this is very self-serving, I appreciate it, but I think that if we got before the nine judges and we got to make our argument and educated them appropriately, that we would have won. So this is a disappointment, but I think it just means that we got to try harder.
Yeah, it definitely will lose in the court of public opinion. We need to thank you as well, Tim, for the many years of dedication that you've provided, not only the French and Mahaffey families, but also families like the Stevensons, Jim and Anna Stevenson, in the death of their son, Christopher. You do tremendous work for victims, particularly families whose children have been subjected to outrageous assault and have been murdered. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your kindness.
Yeah, no, it's so easy to just say, hey, Tim, tell us about this, tell us about that, tell us about the other. But we don't see how many hours and the dedication and that you present and how close to the families you are and what you mean to them. Bernardo, you've told us in the past that he's an arrogant bastard and how he behaves with total indifference toward the families and the victims at his parole hearings. He's now going to see this as some sort of victory for him that he can use at his next parole hearing, I would suspect.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, you know, certainly he knows that he doesn't have to disclose information that would certainly have to be disclosed in a courtroom. And, you know, one of the issues that that we were addressing was whether, you know, the open court principle applies to parole hearings. And the answer to that is, of course, the open court principle applies to tribunals across Canada, which includes the parole board. And this decision says, no, the parole board's different. So the open court principle does not apply to a process where the parole hearings themselves are open to the public. So there's a kind of a disconnect intellectually and legally that I just find difficult to appreciate. And this was the opportunity for the Supreme Court of Canada to address that critically important issue. But to give you an example, when we do our the victim impact statements, and this is a very, very important point, not just for the Frenches and the Mahaffeys, but all the victims who I've represented over the decades, and that is they're not interested in revenge. They're interested in justice. And when they see from parole hearing to parole hearing, the psychopaths, who one of their hallmarks is manipulation and deception and lying, doing precisely that, then, you know, they allow us to file victim impact statements where we use our best memory and recollection as to what occurred. That's okay. But what we can't have is an actual transcript of the hearing, which would make sure that the parole board had the exact facts. Now, how does that make any sense?
It doesn't. It really doesn't. Tim, I again, thank you from all of us for what you do, and thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Thanks for inviting me,
George. Always appreciate it. All the best.
We are a small country, and we cannot afford to lose any war. So when anybody, and we've said at the outset, and this is nothing new to anyone, when anybody harms Israel, if anybody hits Israel, Israel will hit back, not just as a retaliation, but to make sure that they will never do that again.
The Israeli ambassador to Canada, Ido Moed, talking about what's to come as Israel will strike back against Iran. Don't know how, and the ambassador obviously wouldn't tell us. But Iran will pay for what they did yesterday. Later on this hour, we'll be speaking with Fleur Hassan Nahum. She's a former deputy mayor of Jerusalem and currently special envoy for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. She'll be joining us on the Roy Green Show. I read an op-ed the other day, and I really paid attention to it, and I showed it to a few people, and everybody had very strong views about it. And as we talk about this, you'll understand, I think, what the views were. The headline of the op-ed is, "Ideology Masking as Leadership Killed the Canadian Dream. Enough of the gaslighting, evading, and deluding. Canada needs to be made ours again." It's a National Post op-ed by the former Chief of Defense Staff, General Rick Hillier. And the general writes, "The cure for what ails us is simple to say, but difficult, perhaps impossible to implement. Leadership." General Hillier, good to have you back on the program. How are you, sir?
Hey, Roy, I'm well. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, this op-ed is going to get a lot of attention. And let me just read the first two sentences and ask you to comment on those. "This is not Canada," quote unquote, is a phrase we hear far too often. It seems to come from every politician from all levels. It's exclaimed after every illegal demonstration, hate crime, block street, gang shooting, home invasion, car theft, and emergency room horror story. This is not Canada. Take us down the road here, General, please.
Well, Roy, I guess what I was articulating there and trying to be a little eloquent in it, I don't know if I was or not, but it's my frustration. I'm a very proud Canadian. I love my country. I served it for most of my life, really all of my adult life. I continue to serve it. I continue to love it. You know, I was born here. I raised my family here. I worked here in my profession as a soldier all of my life, as I said. And I see things happening in Canada that are destroying the Canada that I knew. And so when people say this is not Canada, well, unfortunately, it is Canada. And we appear very quiet and very complacent in the face of all those things that you just read out from that editorial and more that I described beside that. And I'm kind of hoping to maybe agitate the silent majority of Canadians who are out there quietly seeing this and equally frustrated to me, to make their voice known and to demand something very, very different from what we've been doing.
Yeah, after those two sentences, it picks up momentum. Where you wrote, "Those exclamations," this is not Canada, "those exclamations ring hollow as food bank lines stretch longer and as hopeless thousand-yard stares of good men and women grow more prevalent, while dreams of home ownership fade, shanty towns grow, and our confidence in the future plummets. We hear the official inflation rate, but it bears little resemblance to our real-life experience. This is not Canada," grates harshly, especially when it comes from those who seem so out of touch with reality. General Hillier, you just described, in those few sentences I just read, several recurring themes on this program that we discuss, that we talk about, that we lament about, that we want answers to, that we want solutions delivered for. And it comes down to what you talk about next, and that's leadership. Leadership. And you go on to other, in your op-ed, other examples of how Canada, well, let me just read a couple of things. "The Canadian Dream, so wonderfully launched in 1867 with the partnership that was the Dominion of Canada, is dead, killed by ideology masking as leadership, slaughtered by economic suicide posing as climate control, bled by crushing taxes, wasted on scandalous and foolish endeavors, crushed by debt that compromises long-term fiscal viability, wounded by battles over responsible care for children, frightened by our abandonment of some 300,000 Canadians, attacked not because they're bombing Gaza, but because they're Jews." I read this and I think, damn it, somebody had to say this.
Well, Roy, I did say it. And I did say it because I've been saying it to friends and business colleagues and people who have similar views for weeks and months now, maybe even years. And I get so frustrated that this country that was a founding member of the United Nations, this country that, you know, was a founding member of NATO, this country that took Vimy Ridge, my goodness, we just celebrated the anniversary on the 9th of April, commemorated it. And we seem to have forgotten that we were the great nation. And And what we did in World War One gave us the confidence and the understanding that doing things as a team was far more powerful than doing things as an individual. And that we learned that some things are worth standing up for and serving for and sacrificing, sometimes to the point of losing your life. We seem to have forgotten so much of that, perhaps all of that. And right now, what I see is that lack of leadership across our nation in so many places. Leadership, I always believe, brings first and foremost a vision. What is it that we are going to be? What is it that we are all striving to become to the benefit of every single one of us? And then you lay out a strategy, the main highways to get to that vision over a period of time. And then you build a plan to get to each intersection on that highway. And then you build priorities to say, this is what each day, each week we're going to do. And this is what the public service of Canada and of each province is going to do to get there. And then you articulate that to Canadians and get their buy-in. And you keep driving towards that vision. And you listen to Canadians. And you shape the approach as you go. I don't see that. And what I see is divisiveness across the country. We're pitting the Maritimes against Ontario, or Alberta and Saskatchewan against the rest, or Quebec against somebody, or different levels of our society. And leaders have a primary responsibility, I believe, to unite our country. That is the primary responsibility. And, you know, I go back again to, you know, World War One, World War Two, Sir Robert Borden, who managed us and led us through that brutal conscription crisis that almost tore the country apart. And Mackenzie King, who in his understated way, and I don't think most Canadians, in fact, very few Canadians understand this, he was probably the greatest influencer of all time because he had the ear of Franklin Roosevelt, the president of the United States during World War II, who really was responsible for the demolishment of Nazi Germany and fascist Japan. And Mackenzie King was his influencer in a way that was incredible, powerful for Canada, because it was powerful for the world. And so we've had that leadership in the past, and Pearson and Mulroney, and yes, Jean Chrétien, who was ruthless in what he determined to do in Canada and really started to accomplish that. We've had that leadership in the past. I'd love to see it again.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about you as a military leader. And here you are, the general, and you're leading your troops. And you were in Afghanistan leading our Canadian forces on the ground. And they trusted you. And I've talked to members of our military who were in battle, who served with you. And invariably, General, they talk about the fact that they respect you. They would follow. I had one soldier say to me, I would follow Rick Hillier anywhere. And that says to me, you provided everything that you just outlined. You provided a goal and a way to get there, and you led the way to that goal. And right now, we seem to be, in my view, and I think yours as well, we seem to be a bewildered nation. We don't really know what to think, what to believe. We turn on each other on a dime. It's very unfortunate. And you go on to write about the economic reality. We could be producing ethical LNG to power the world, you write. Canadian LNG can replace coal for power generation throughout much of Asia and the rest of the world, reducing global carbon emissions by millions of tons while creating massive economic benefits for Canadians. Our contribution and leadership to combat climate change should be enormous, not ludicrous. You'll get pushback on that, right? I mean, you will.
Well, There is lots of pushback on that. And no, you know, hey, no matter what you say, no matter what you're right, no matter who you are, not everybody is going to agree with any of those three things, if you will. But, you know, I was out in Prince Rupert in June, and I was at the liquefied natural gas processing facility being built there. It's an enormous facility. It's going to process so much of that natural gas, liquefy it and ship it to China and other parts of Asia. And what they were saying was that because of what they were doing, in China alone, some 12 electrical generating stations would be able to convert from coal to that liquefied natural gas. And in those 12 alone, literally hundreds of thousands or millions of tons of emissions per year would be eliminated and therefore reduced overall around the rest of the world. Can you imagine if we multiply that by 100 and what an impact we could have on climate control, climate change, and do it in a massive way for the globe? Not trying to do it as a little bit of making Canada the Green Boy Scout, so we can sort of thump our chest in front of the rest of the world, but have made no real big difference. Let's make a real big difference. Let's do something like that and benefit Canadians at the same time. The world's been begging for Canadian liquefied natural gas. The world has been begging for Canada's energy, which is produced in a more ethical, regulated, and environmentally friendly manner than anywhere else in the world. And yet we're not doing that. Let's do that and make a real difference in climate control and climate change.
General, if we talk about it, and I thought about this for a couple of days since I read your op-ed, and you kindly agreed to come on the air with me. I thought the Victoria Cross, which symbolizes everything that we hope will come forward in people under the most dangerously stressful times, it's a recognition of that. We haven't awarded the Canadian Victoria Cross since World War II. We didn't have one until fairly recently. It was just the Victoria Cross. But you and I have talked about, with Bruce Moncour, who made most of us on this program aware of Private Jess La Rochelle. Can you just remind us, please, of Private La Rochelle, what he contributed, and why he deserved the Victoria Cross, which he never received, and he's now passed away?
Roy, unfortunately, as you mentioned, we lost that beautiful young man last August, just a young man. I think he was 41 when he passed. And in my view, he passed because of the wounds that he took on the 14th of October, 2006, and the care and the medications that he had over the intervening years and destroyed his body. And we lost him last summer. On the 14th of October, 2006, in Strong Point Center, Private Jess La Rochelle, just a young man out of Nipissing, Ontario, a young man that any of us more mature adults would love to call our son, would love to call as part of our family. He's that kind of individual, quiet, you know, worked well with people, a little sense of humor, liked to have a beer once in a while, and just unassuming, no braggart. He showed up with his platoon at Strong Point Center. They were alerted an attack was coming in. They were shorthanded because one of the three sections of that platoon was back in Kandahar, and they needed to get sort of all-round defense. The Section 2IC, Master Corporal Jeremy LeBlanc, said, like, I've got to put somebody up in that mud tower as an observation post. We normally never put just one person in a post by themselves, always two minimum. That's a tactical sort of paradigm that we always use. He said, we don't have enough people to do it. Do I have a volunteer from one person to go in? Jess shot his hand up and said, I'll do it. He got into that mud observation post, a tower, and seconds after he arrived there, the Taliban attacked in force. He was on the machine gun there. He had about 800 rounds for his machine gun, and he was firing into the attackers as they were coming at him, firing at the rest of the platoon with machine gun and with rocket-propelled grenades. In the opening seconds of that fight, a rocket-propelled grenade came into the mud wall tower, detonated. Jess was knocked back against the steel-hard mud wall baked in the desert for hundreds of years, literally, and knocked back into it by that explosion. He said, when I came to after a few seconds, I looked up. He said, it was like Star Wars. There was so much light and activity going on with me because the enemy was still firing at him. He got himself back into the fight. Firing his machine gun. He kept 100 rounds and didn't use those as a last-ditch defense. And then he started picking up M72 rocket launchers, which were in the tower. And they're a cardboard tube rocket launcher. You pick it up, you pop the end caps off, you extend it, the sight pops up, you fire it and throw it, throw away the tube. He started firing one after another at the Taliban attacking him, firing at one individual fighter at a time, still under fire himself. And eventually the attack, because of his fire, petered out. The platoon commander, Ray Novak, went bounding up to that spot. And when he got close to the observation post, he said, there's nobody that could be alive in that. It was absolutely destroyed. And then this little head popped itself up, and it was Jess La Rochelle. And hey, sir, I'll provide you covering fire. Come on in. Ray went into the observation post, talked with Jess, and said, okay, you know, you've done your job here. I'll get somebody to replace you. And Jess said, no, sir. I know the lay of the land. I've got it figured out here now. Don't put somebody else through this. I'll stay. So he stayed until darkness. Then he got reinforced, I believe it was, by the platoon warrant officer, and they stayed overnight, holding the enemy off. The next morning, he went into Kandahar with the rest of his platoon to carry and help carry the body of his best friend Private Blake Williamson onto the aircraft for that last journey home. It was only after that he went to the medic for the company and said, "Hey, I'm hurting a little bit." And what was discovered immediately, of course, was that when that rocket-propelled grenade exploded at the start of the fight, and when he was slammed into the wall, he had a retina on his right eye, which detached. His eardrums were broken. He was concussed and
bleeding
through the eardrums, and his back was broken.
It's just the most incredible story.
He got back in the fight.
And he deserved and earned the Victoria Cross. General Hillier, it's an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for joining us.
Roy, thank you for having me on. Pleasure to chat.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.